So I started 2021 in winter. I want to become a professional gravel racer. Everyone was laughing about that in Germany. And then did the first races in the States. And I was not good. I was okay, but I was suffering quite a lot. And so it was for me like I needed 2 years to actually like kind of find my way back into like feeling strong and being able to be competitive.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo. Yeah. This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we talking about practice.
Hey, Pete, on the dude's rug.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. This is the last intro I'm going to be recording from Girona, Spain for a little while at least. Tomorrow morning, we head back to the U.S. Before anything else, I want to give a big shout out to Athletic Affair. This isn't an ad, but I want to give them a shout out. Athletic Affair hooked us up with an awesome studio for pretty much the entire time we were here in Spain, all 3 months, and we were able to just crank on the podcast at a quality level that we haven't kind of since pre-pandemic, I would say, at least in terms of consistency. So big, big thanks to that crew. They're really a friendly group of folks doing some awesome stuff in the outdoor space and marketing, content creation, community development, all that sort of thing. Go give them a follow on the IG if you like. Today's guest, Paul Voss, is someone that I did not know personally at all before today's episode. Literally had not spoken a word to him, I don't think, even though we'd been wheel to wheel on plenty of occasions over the last handful of years. Paul is one of the European racers who's made the trip over to the US for some of our biggest races pretty frequently over the last few years. And to be honest, I didn't know a whole lot about him the first couple of years, and then gradually started to hear a little bit, and then I started doing my own research, started following him on Instagram. He has an incredible story, and he's someone who turns out is pretty thoughtful as well, super well-spoken in English, which is impressive and we're really grateful for, and was down to kind of be a straight shooter. This guy's about his business when it comes to bike racing and also when it comes to podcasting. He has two of his own podcasts, not really hobby podcasts. They are professional businesses. There are a lot of bike racers with kind of hobby podcasts out there, but seemingly like a lot of other things that Paul does, he applies all of himself to those projects as well as his bike racing, which have delivered some pretty incredible results over the years, from wearing the polka dot jersey at the Tour de France to winning the Traca 200 last year. Really enjoyed getting to know Paul a lot better during this conversation, and I'm looking forward to racing with him throughout the year. Sit back and enjoy. Thanks for listening today. So we were basically talking about right before we started recording here,
you were asking why we decided to do Girona when most of my races are in the States, because it doesn't really make sense. But Dennis Van Winden's my coach. And also, the training here is just so hard to beat, man, as I'm sure you know. Like, especially when you're a multidiscipline athlete, if I had to, for some reason, just quit riding mountain bikes and quit riding gravel bikes, I could still be a happy cyclist here. Mm-hmm. Obviously, because the road riding is so insane. And most of the places we go in the States, eventually it gets old. And I have not even close to getting tired of it yet.
But it's not everyone saying that where you guys are living is the best place to ride your bike.
For here, it might be, well, I don't know. Because then I did this little mini trip to the Pyrenees, mm-hmm. Puig Cerda, and did couple rides in Andorra and stuff, and that was pretty mind-blowing also.
Okay,
but anyway, so tell me about your, you lived here for 5 years and you were mm-hmm. saying you got here pretty early, like right after that first U.S. postal wave of riders.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as most people know, like Lance was living here and some of the other guys, and back in 2011, some of my Australian teammates, I was riding for a British team back then, they were based here over the summer, and I came to visit them, and then in the winter I decided to move over. And then during the winter, we were just like four or five guys, Christian Meyer,
yeah,
Daniel Martin, David Miller, and a few others. And it was actually quite nice to be in town. Everyone's just speaking Catalan or Spanish.
Uh-huh.
I mean, now it's crazy. It doesn't matter where you are. You hear a lot of Germans, a lot of English speakers. And yeah, it was a really good time. And then it was crazy how fast the city developed, like to be like the cycling capital in Europe, I would say. First cycling, then triathlon. So yeah, so it has changed a lot. But then at one point, end of my road career, 2016, I decided I have to move back to Germany because just got a bit too busy here.
Yeah. Okay. Just too cycling centric?
Yeah. Huh. So I mean, yeah, just too cycling centric. I mean, now I do enjoy to be here. But I don't know if I could live again for like the whole year. Yeah. It's nice to have like a different input from different sides. I mean, I'm living in Berlin, which is like a city with many faces, and I think I will miss it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's a good jumping off point, I think. Cause how long was your career in the World Tour? Like 7 years, 8 years?
Starting 2009 until end of 16.
Yeah. And there were some really impressive performances in there. I mean, you were on obviously some of the most successful teams, Milram, Bora, raced three tours.
Yeah, three tours. I think three Vuelta and one Giro. Yeah.
Yeah. How old were you when you stopped racing at that level?
30. Yeah.
30.
Just 30. Yeah.
Why did you stop then?
It was a complicated situation. I had actually my best years, or my best year. I could wear the polka dot jersey at the tour for one day, the first stage, and then won a race, and was actually quite good in the most races. So, I already agreed by handshake for a new contract already before the tour back then, and but then the whole Sagan thing started to happen.
Oh, no way. His move to Bora.
Yeah. And so in the end, there was no budget.
Wow.
And so there was... The interesting thing is Ralf Denk just published a book like a few months ago. And actually in that book, specifically, he talked about that situation that he couldn't keep me on the team because of Sagan coming into the team with like 10 other riders.
Wow.
So it's nice to read that in the aftermath. But we'll have
a little late, dude.
Yeah, a little late. Would also have been nice to just like being straightforward in that moment and saying, hey man, we just don't have any budget, because back then it was just like a bit, yeah, you know how cycling is sometimes in the big teams. They're not reacting, not saying anything, you know, and you just keep waiting. So at one point I just said, okay, either I get a contract in a big team or I stop. So for me, it was not even the option there to like go down again to a Conti team, which I have done after Milram, which was actually quite good because I went to Enduro Racing. And then we won like the Europe Tour and we were really, really successful. We had a big budget, so we got paid really well. And it was a lot of fun. But I didn't want to do it again. So I decided, okay, I'm going to stop. And back then I had the option to start as a sports director for the Team Wiggins. So I always like to work with young people, and so that was like for me a good option to just stop cycling and go into a new role.
Yeah. One of the things that I've really enjoyed about spending time here in Girona is just being in this place, seeing a lot of the people that are involved with this sport, which is obviously so European based. Little conversations you have at the coffee shop. That combined with some of what you read in the news, like the whole B&B hotels issue, in a way, a similar thing where it sounds like so much of the funding was tied up in Cavendish going to the team. And we had Heidi Franz on the podcast and she talked about how, you know, the floor just completely dropped out from under her professionally because everything fell through. And it's just so crazy to hear how messy it can be, the cycling. And I have to assume it's the same way in other sports to an extent, but in the moment, like when that's falling apart and you're having to make a decision about what your next move is, which was retirement, and you've, you know, poured your heart and soul into the sport, done so many intervals, so many long days in the rain since, I don't know when you started, but I'm guessing 12, 14 years old.
Yeah.
How hard was that? Like, how angry were you? How frustrated? Because it had to have just felt so unfair. Were you mad at Sagan even for bringing 10 dudes to to have so much power, you know? Because that's a weird thing too, for a single rider to have so much power where he can just say, I want these guys on the team. And people like you just, sorry.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of understand it because it was a business decision. Ralf Denk and most cycling, or most, yes, cycling team managers are businessmen. So they want to make more money or want to have a bigger budget. And bringing Sagan on was a huge step. And yeah, I had to pay for that. I mean, again, in the aftermath, I'm fine with it. In the moment, obviously, I was angry is the wrong word. Maybe disappointed because I was there for the team all the time. And I was also like doing a lot of media things for the team. And it also in the moment where like German cycling wasn't in a good state, I was not one of the big guys like Greipel and Kittel. So I didn't win the big races, but I had a good relationship with the media. And, you know, I tried to be like a positive figure, you know, like telling a different story and so on. So, and then leaving the sport that way wasn't so nice, but in the end, I have to say I'm happy that I kind of decided to stop and had to stop in a way, because it opened so many doors. I started commentating for German television, so I did a tour as a commentator for many years and started my first podcast and then the second podcast. So much more opened, you know, like and also that thing with gravel now, I think I wouldn't have done if I had continued in cycling, because I didn't went into gravel because I wanted to go away from the road. I just saw it as like an opportunity, you know, not really as like I don't like road anymore. Even today, if someone will come and give me like a serious offer, I might take it. I mean, I'm now too old. I know that. With like,
how old are you?
37, yeah.
Okay.
Turning 38.
Prime age for a gravel racer.
Let's see for how long. I will probably still take it because I like the world of road cycling and I like being competitive. I like doing the intervals. I like being in this rapid hole, you know, like doing all the things you have to do. So, yeah, I think that's why I have a bit of a different relationship with like this whole gravel thing than maybe some other world tour riders.
Interesting. I definitely want to talk about that in a second, but you alluded to something that I think would be really cool to talk about. So for those that don't know, you basically said Germany had a really bad relationship with professional cycling. It seems like it's gotten lots better, but from like the late 2000s into the 2010s, there was like this rehabilitation phase post Jan Ulrich, post Andreas Klöden, whoever else you want to throw to the mix, due to the really gnarly years of doping. It sounds like did you take it upon yourself to play a role in that rehabilitation process? Like you mentioned that you made yourself really available to the media and were putting extra effort in and being a spokesperson for the sport within Germany. What was that about? Like, why were you putting extra effort in?
I mean, I wasn't a big figure like Greipel and Kittel, who did like the biggest German newspaper. They make like this one thing and saying, I don't know what it was about, but it's basically saying, we will never dope and here we sign it, whatever. I see. So I never did something like this. I wasn't, as I said, not such a big figure. But with like the TV stations, like especially the German TV stations, you know, I just try to be there, you know, like if they ask questions, you know, also about doping, like just giving a straight opinion, you know, not talking about it and saying, oh, nah, blah, blah, blah. So for me, it was just like always, no, I will never do it. I haven't done it. And if someone asks me, I give them my 2 cents, you know, whatever. So yeah. It was more about that. And I think that way I tried to help. But it was also the time where I, you know, when I took a taxi to the airport and you start talking with the taxi driver and they ask you what you're doing, I will never say I'm a cyclist, you know?
Really?
Yeah. Always wow. Like, because it was really a time where like everyone you met said, oh, you must use doping, you know, otherwise you can't be successful. And so that has changed, luckily.
But why do you think, sorry to interrupt, but why do you think that happened in Germany? Because for some reason it seems like, and of course it happened throughout the world, but it depended on who you talked to, what their opinion was. Like, I think in some other countries, people were willing to change their opinion a little bit more quickly. I know that's a broad statement, but
yeah,
it's just my impression.
Germans are really critical.
Uh-huh.
And we have seen it quite often in German sports history that you have someone who, when he's on the top, you laugh him. But as soon as he is falling, you just hitting him all the time. And in that case, it was first Ulrich, but then the whole cycling, you know, professional cycling. And I mean, we had like Eric Zabel, who was like kind of famous. We actually had Ulrich. Eric Zabel actually confessed, and then also Rolf Aldag and so on in a big PR or like big press conference. And Ulrich actually, I think if Ulrich will have said back then, yes, I did it, I think it will have changed things. Hmm. But it was just really complicated situation and relationship with like the normal people and cycling.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Man, such a shame that you didn't even feel comfortable.
Yeah, but you know, I was lucky enough to like the end of my career, I felt it started to change.
Uh-huh.
But like when I turned professional, it was definitely like not a good place to be a professional cyclist in Germany. It was also a time where there was not much money in cycling. So now the salaries are higher. So like I was a pro, but didn't earn that much. Also because big companies didn't want to invest into cycling. It has changed also in Germany. So all these things, but I don't want to cry about it. You know, it's just,
no, I get it.
It's just how it is. And again, I learned a lot in that time. And
why do you think as a young rider, you even wanted to get into the sport? Was all of that on your mind and thinking like, this seems like a negative, culturally, there's a lot of negativity around this sport. Did that give you pause as you chased the dream as a junior in U23 at all?
I mean, first there was like a massive hype as a lot of people in Germany started riding my bike like 97, 98, you know, with like Jan Ulrich winning the Tour, becoming second. Then he is becoming an Olympic champion in 2000 and then the comeback with T-Mobile and Bianchi and so on. So there was like a lot of love story as well, and that motivated you, you know, like, and but then yeah, of course at one point, I mean, you know that you decide for yourself, I want to become a professional cyclist, and then it actually doesn't matter what happens around you.
Yeah.
So when I turned when I went into under 23, became even more successful and like then got a chance to sign a contract. It wasn't the best state for like German cycling, but yeah, it didn't matter really for me. Yeah
makes sense. Okay, so when you did step away, when you did get forced out of Bora, what did you go do? Were you a director with Wiggins?
Yeah, I was a sports director for Wiggins. And that was actually quite a good year. It was a lot of fun. It was a big change. I remember like the first stage race for them I did was Coppi Bartoli in Italy. And I fell every day asleep in the car. I was lucky enough to have like a mechanic driving the car to the start and then from the finish to the hotel again. And I was so not used to like just sitting still and not being active that my whole body was just like on the limit without doing anything actually, you know, but
whoa,
like,
yeah.
But just like being aware all the time and organizing things. So I just, yeah, fell asleep all the time. And one day we almost missed the start because I was, my responsibility was to like make the navigation to the start. And I fell asleep and we just went past the actual start for like half an hour and we had to turn around. So there was like, yeah, there was a...
Yikes.
That, yeah, was a hard learning curve, but I really enjoyed it. And yeah, it was a good start for me. And then I wanted to help a German team, German continental team. So I decided to like change to them in 2018. And then I worked for like a German continental team for 3 years. Yeah, until COVID happened. Yeah.
Did you keep riding for that time?
Yeah, a bit. I started running and enjoyed it. And then I thought about the running career.
Really?
I mean, I'm so competitive.
Yeah.
So as soon as I start something, I want to be as good as possible. But yeah, I kept riding a bit, but for sure not as much as I do now again. Yeah.
Yeah. So at what point did kind of a second phase of the racing career come into focus as a possibility?
That was when COVID happened in March 21, I think, huh?
2020. Yeah.
Yeah, so like the first COVID summer, we started racing again. And I was still a sports director. I felt really unhappy because the months prior, just sitting at home and nothing to do, or you were not allowed to do anything, I was just thinking a lot and thought, okay, there's something not finished. You know, I felt really with like cycling, I felt I have to do something, you know, like either do my own team or like start racing again, but I have to do something for myself because I gave, I don't know, it sounds a bit weird, but like I felt I gave a lot before to other people. I had... So like during my last years of my work career, I started my own team, my own junior team.
Oh, wow.
And then...
While you were still racing with Bora?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, yeah. And I had a few sponsors, also Bora funded it. And then when I stopped in 2017, the team was still existing. And I actually spent all my money I have saved for that team. So...
No way.
Yeah, so I gave all my money to the juniors and... So it was kind of like, okay, because you get like this funding, you know, like end of your career when you're paying in, you get like whatever, 20,000 euros and then like some savings I had. I spent all for this team because I was hoping that maybe the year after a sponsor comes in, but it didn't happen. So I had to stop the team and then yeah, I started at the German contender team. Yeah, so I had actually like worked for two teams then. And so I have spent a lot of money for others and time and... you know, private relationships were not that great because I kept being away, you know?
Yeah.
And then I said, okay, I want to do something for myself, you know? And then I said, okay, I saw that gravel thing. I knew about Unbound. I'm coming from cyclocross, so I'm being first successful off-road.
Before, oh, really? I didn't know that. Okay.
Before I started on the road to become good. And therefore I thought, all right, that's a really... It could be a really nice possibility. And then I just wrote a concept down, went to like a few sponsors I knew, and then it happened quite quickly. Yeah.
Okay, so I want to go back to starting a junior team and spending, making a donation of tens of thousands of dollars to make a junior team happen. That's really unusual.
Yeah, I'm sometimes too idealistic, you know, like I have like, yeah, that was stupid in a way, but I really wanted to make it work. And yeah, so that's why I did it. And, you know, because in Germany, the whole system has changed now, but it's a bit different to like maybe the US. Usually the junior teams or the bigger junior teams are funded by the regions.
Mm.
So it's like kind of like public money. There's also private money in there, but mainly public. So it's like this structure I didn't like because it's all about performance. So people who are not maybe in that state at that moment but still have talent but need time, most of the time don't have any chance. And I kind of wanted to change that and give people or like kids their chance. So that was the idea. We worked for 2 years. We were okay, successful, but yeah, it didn't work out in the end.
Yeah.
So junior team is not a business model.
Not very profitable, huh? Yeah. Man, that's a whole other conversation about the development pathways of young riders. I don't know that it's necessarily better in the US because I remember just based on my own experience, I grew up in Central Texas, sea level, and the first USA Cycling Talent ID camp I went to was at over 2,000 meters in Colorado Springs, just because that's where USA Cycling is. Mm. And like 80% of the attendees were totally not acclimated. And we did like a 20-minute hill climb, you know, up to 2,500 meters. And then they based all of this selection criteria on the... And it was just like... And at the moment, I didn't understand. You know, I didn't have the context of how much difference altitude makes or the fact that I'd never even done a 20-minute climb. You know, and that's just an example. But I think your point about where a young rider is in their own development, where they are in their life, literally where they're coming from geographically, has such huge impacts on their potential trajectory. And somehow casting a wider net, I mean, even we were talking earlier about Sepp. I grew up racing on the USA Cycling mountain bike national team with Sepp. And he'd typically do a bit better than me at the U23 World Cups and Junior World Cups and that sort of thing. But at no point was there an indication based on results that he could win a Grand Tour.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not even close. You could go back and look at some of his results, but I'm sure he would... talk about this too. And he just wasn't in the right environment, like physiologically, psychologically, whatever it is. He was more geared to a different discipline. I don't know how within junior development of cycling, Germany, US, whoever, we all do a better job of identifying talent and helping nurture it and develop it. But it does seem like there's a lot of room for improvement there. I guess it is better now with, you know, power data and all of these different things, but it's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, but also junior ranks getting professionalized when you look at like this German Bora team, Auto Eder.
Mm.
I don't know if they still call Auto Eder, but they basically have the same equipment and you know, that they have all the support you can get, and it's hard to compete. You know, it's like if you're just riding for a club and you're just a standard road bike, you know, just talking about tires these days makes such a huge difference.
Yeah.
Either you have the best tires available or you have kind of like a mid-range tire. It could make a big difference. And so it's getting even more unequal. I don't know if that's a word, yeah. But...
there are more barriers, potentially.
Yeah, there are more barriers, but I also think they're now more aware of like... how to look after talent. So it's not just like the pure, like, let's say power number. It's more parameters now as well. So yeah.
I'm still kind of hung up on this. The fact that you just donated so much money to make this happen. Is that a...
It's not a donation. You know, like I tried...
It's an investment. Yeah. Investment.
Yeah.
Fair.
Yeah.
Fair.
Yeah. So I just tried to help these boys. So, but I mean one of them was my brother, I have to say.
Yeah.
So I was also like, of course... one of the reasons to do it. But yeah, in the end, I mean, my sister was heavily involved as well.
Yeah.
Working there for free. So yeah, it was a family thing.
Does that sort of, like, do you find yourself wanting to help people in that way, invest in them, whether it's financially or time-wise, throughout your life? Or was that kind of a special thing?
Yeah, I mean, that's how I grew up. We are four siblings, so I'm kind of in a big family, and that's how I learned from my mother. And also my sister, she stopped actually now working in cycling, but she was also working a whole time with the junior national team on the track as a physio, and worked for the Conti teams I was working for. So yeah, every one of us has it kind of in the genes, you know, like we just want to help. And I was coaching also a lot of young guys, yeah, until last year. So yeah, I just like to kind of not teach them something, but like, yeah, give them my experience and hopefully they're not taking this or making the same mistakes. And
Yeah, cool. So I'm really curious about your journey of finding a top level as a cyclist again, because you had a pretty big gap where you weren't training at a professional level. Well, actually we should set some groundwork real quick there first. How do you train now? Do you train like you did when you were at the highest level?
No, it's totally different.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And also all the watts and VO2 max I'm doing now, it's just so different to when I've been there. So I'm now much better than on the road.
You're better now than you were then?
Yeah.
Really?
So it's like from all the parameters. Obviously not the, I don't know, I never do 1 minute or 5 minute tests, but yeah, I'm through like all the endurance values, yeah, I'm much better. But you know, like back then, you never thought about nutrition.
Right, true, yep.
You know, eating 120 carbs an hour, yeah. It's like, you know, like you had one bottle for like 5 hours. So it's, you can't compare it really, you know. And then the training, I think I had a quite advanced training back then. I had a coach here from Girona who was really good and tried out a lot of things, but still it wasn't as advanced as now. I mean, now you just open Google, type something in, and then you kind of, I mean, almost everyone is able to like make himself a really good training program just, you know, out of like researching a bit.
So you're the first person who I've heard say that you're better now than when you, well, so quickly, wore polka dots at the tour. You won a really unique first stage at Volta Catalunya where you got to wear the leader's jersey. Levi Leipheimer was second, Andreas Klöden third, pretty good. But your watts are better now. And when I talk to folks like yourself who've come from the top level of road cycling, sometimes they say they have numbers that are pretty equal. Maybe they have one power test that was a bit better, but usually it's like, ah, oh, I'm a little heavier. Ah, oh, I don't train as much. Like they really downplay it. And I think it's interesting that you're just kind of owning like, no, I'm better. And the second part to that is as someone who didn't ever race in the World Tour, there's a little bit of insecurity I have sometimes of like, I will never be able to achieve a level of some of the guys who I'm racing against were able to because they race Grand Tours. They did these crazy training camps with World Tour support. And you're saying training has advanced so much that maybe I'm overestimating the impact of that.
So also back then, you know, you trained that what everyone else did, you know? So it wasn't as customized. And as I said, I think my training was for that time advanced, but of course, when I did like 40-20s or 30-30s, V2 max intervals, it was always full gas. Mm. Now I never, literally the only time I go full gas is maybe in racing. Mm. I never go all out these days. And so there are like so many things which have changed. And I know also back then, that I was too, I don't know how to say in English, I was thinking too much. So I was often in situations to get like really, really good results at like really good races, but my head just blocked everything.
Hmm.
So I was actually never really able to really show my full potential.
Because can you give an example from a race?
For 2 years, I had like a stomach issue where like under stress, just I had to go to the toilet in the race.
Oh, interesting.
So going into like the final of Amstel Gold Race, into like the last climb to the Forza finish line, and then just like I had to kind of stop.
Really?
I didn't have to stop in that moment, but
yeah,
like
you couldn't had to get keep, off the I gas. Couldn't,
yeah, yeah, keep yeah. going.
It's interesting.
Going for like a Giro stage, we're going for the win in that group, and then like, you know, like just from the paper I was one of the fastest, but not like being able to actually deliver because doing stupid things in the final and like going
overthinking
wrong position.
It.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's crazy. This has changed so much since I stopped because now I'm just things happen automatically. So like, I mean, to be in the World Tour, I think you need to have a killer instinct until like a certain point. And then you lose it when you become a worker or whatever, or domestique. And I was second at the European Championships, winning their sprint against Ben Swift and so on. So I was in under 23, one of the best. Turning professional was good. But then like at one point I just lost it, you know, lost the mojo, how to like position myself, how to like really like go, yeah, go in the right position and so on. And I mean, also for the tour, just doing stupid things like trying to be as light as possible. At one point I was like 62 kilos doing a training camp on myself in the Pyrenees while I was living in Girona, altitude training camp. And every day I came home with a hunger flat every day.
Wow.
And then rating my food after the training, which is totally stupid.
Yeah.
You wouldn't do that today, you know? So such a thing, and you're going into a grand tour and you're feeling good for 1 or 2 days, but then you're not recovering. Yeah. And yeah. So a lot of, I will never say I will have won big races, but I certainly did a lot of mistakes during my career, which I'm not doing anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting. Peter Vakosh talked about this a little bit too. Just the difference where you can, hypothetically, you're the exact same athlete physiologically. But if that killer instinct isn't there, you'll be 17th wheel instead of fourth wheel at a critical point. Or, you know, you won't attack. You will follow whoever attacks next, and you miss these opportunities. And it's such a razor thin margin between having the killer instinct to win or get a result or just be a good cyclist. And I haven't raced much in Europe, period. I mean, mostly the racing I've done in Europe has been off-road, but the little bit of gravel racing that I've done, the last couple of gravel worlds, and then on, it sounds silly to say because it's not a huge race, but even the third stage of Saint-Avi was such an eye-opener for me coming from the United States, because you get just a little taste of how much of a killer you have to be, even in a gravel race nowadays that's like in mid-February, because the first hour had, you know, a lot of road furniture, tiny roads, all these different things. And I felt so overwhelmed by the people who were willing to just take the position, you know. And in the States, you just do whatever you want. And so much of it is like road infrastructure or the style of course, the length of the race. If you have the legs, you will do well, pretty much.
Yeah.
Unless something bad happens, if you have the legs, you will do well. And the racing style, from what I can tell so far and what it sounds like you're saying, especially here in Europe, like that's just not enough. You have to have this like assassin's mindset to just do the thing at the right moment.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, on the road, you need, as same in gravel, you need also then the power, the watts. And yeah, but yeah, as I said, that's like a lot of, it's a big learning curve for me. And I was surprised by myself that I was actually able to, now in gravel, having a different mindset. So also in training and not overthinking things. And it's quite interesting. Yeah. But also I think back then was like a different environment. I think these days that wouldn't happen because the sports directors will have been more cautious, you know, like maybe I think these days I'm more able to actually work with young athletes than I've been back then, because there was a really, you're coming to a training camp and then the old guy's just trying to fuck you, you know?
Yeah.
So half wheeling you all day long until you pull out and...
Just an alpha thing.
Yeah. So, and also the sports directors, yeah. I mean, they have been riders before and even in the, you know, like the generation before. So it was even more like that. And I think these days becoming a young professional, it's not easier, but I think they're looking more after you. Even though I guess these guys saying also and girls, it's not the case, but I'm pretty sure it's not as rough as it was when I turned professional.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, it's interesting to me that you say you don't totally empty yourself in training these days, which is from what I'm learning from my coach, like that's a very responsible thing to do. But as an athlete, I think that's very hard to do. And for me, if I have any insecurity, especially early season, about how training's been going or, you know, whatever, I just need to prove to myself. But you don't feel the need to like prove it to yourself in training per se.
I feel the need, but I always tell myself, trust the process. Yeah. And it's really, I mean, I'm following you, I'm following a lot of guys, and of course, when I see what you guys doing and training, and then you're showing your warts, I'm like, oh, fuck, I'm actually able to do that, you know? And so I'm coming also into the race as being kind of insecure, you know, if I'm there. But I also know that with my new coach, which I have now for like 1.5 years, that we found the way of training which is working for me.
Yeah.
So what I'm doing doesn't mean that it's working for someone else, you know?
Totally.
So, and I think you have to understand that. And also that's, it makes no sense to look at your power data, you know, because if you lose yourself in the numbers of someone else, I think, and you're not lost then, but, and it's the wrong word for it, lost, but
yeah, kinda, you're not focusing on the thing that's important.
So I'm, you know, for me, it's also hard. I never do like 20-minute test, 5-minute test, 1-minute test. So I don't know how good I am. And I just do like 2-3 times a year lab test, and I do races.
Yeah.
And I mean, just yesterday I did like the 100K recon for like Trucker 100, and I didn't feel as usual. And I thought, oh, I would just like to do now like a 5-minute all out and just to know, you know.
Put your mind at ease.
Yeah. But then I was like, nah, it's do your stuff, do what you have to do, and trust the process. And that's really helping me to like stay focused and like just, you know, like ticking the boxes. So for me, training is not about enjoyment anymore. It's not because I don't like cycling, but I know I have to do this work to enjoy racing, you know? So yeah, that's also learning.
Yeah. Man, that's fascinating. How long did it take it sounds like you kind of started transitioning back into training in 2020 during the pandemic. How quickly did it come back?
So I started 2021 in winter. I want to become a professional gravel racer. Everyone was laughing about that in Germany. And then did the first races in the States, and I was not good. I was okay, but I was suffering quite a lot. And so it was for me like I needed 2 years to actually like kind of find my way back into like feeling strong and being able to, be competitive. Yeah.
Interesting. At this stage, you know, so we have this absolute explosion of different directions you can take a gravel career. You can do the UCI stuff. You can do the Grand Prix. You can do all the stuff that's not that, which is like Belgium Waffle Ride. There's loads of races here in Europe now that are not UCI gravel that are Trakke. Would you consider Trakke your biggest gravel success thus far, by the way? Last year, the Trakke 200?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Europeans was also huge. You were third? Third at European Championships last year.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, they're all kind of equal. Of course, like Trakke was emotional with like the finishing, running the last K, and with like, because year before I lost someone really important, so it was like, it was good to get the win in there, you know, and then like to get the self-belief and just see, okay, actually the work I've done over the winter, changing coach and so on, is paying out. And so Trakke was an important step.
Yeah. Speaking of Trakke, quickly, have you ridden the new course?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first climb is the same as in the 100 loop. I'm actually going to do the recon tomorrow from the 200. And yeah, I prefer that it's hard from the beginning, because last year was a bit of not so enjoyable.
Yeah, I heard the group got huge.
Yeah, and was quite dangerous in some bits. So this year having a quite hard climb from the beginning.
Dude, it's so gnarly.
Yeah.
I reconned with Jasper and Ivar and a couple other guys, and I was mind blown. I mean, we were on the pedals and we averaged 20K an hour for the first 40K.
Yeah.
We don't really have anything like that in the US. I mean, I guess sort of, I don't know, Crusher is kind of like that with a huge climb right off the bat, but a lot of the gravel here is just, because it's weird. You'd think with it being Europe, you'd expect it to be very road inspired.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it is, but a lot of the courses are super gnarly, man. It's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, especially here, this region and Klaasmarkt, I like to, it's a bit like BWRs, you know,
you have
something sneaky in there, you know, you feel good and say it's a nice course and then I put something in where you say it's like, we don't need it necessarily. And a trucker is a bit the same, and but in a positive way. And it's a tough course. But yeah, European gravel is so diverse. So like to say trucker is a blueprint, it's far away from being the truth.
What does your year look like? Speaking of racing, how are you going about deciding the direction you want to take your career?
So I have like two big goals this year. The first is Unbound, and then a Worlds, because the Worlds on a similar course as the European Championships. And leading up to Unbound is Trucker, Aachen, and like a few other UCI races. The biggest focus is on Unbound, because I know that I mean, unfortunately, we have a lot of American listeners, so probably also the race organizer. So I don't, it's not my favorite race.
But I don't know that it is many people's favorite race. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that.
But it's the most important race. And I saw it with Carolyn Schiff last year. I mean, we're traveling a lot. We have a podcast together, so we have friends. And I saw what it has changed for her. And I kind of want that change for myself. So that's like a big, it's a big goal for me. And then the Worlds, obviously. Yeah.
As an athlete at your level, I think it would be fun for you to kind of describe however you want to describe it, just how different Unbound is versus what Worlds is going to be, what Europeans was last year, because they're almost different sports.
Yeah. So the training is also totally different. So that's why I have to cut my season in like two parts. I mean, Unbound is just with the North course now. I never done that before. But I saw it looks pretty rough and harder, much harder than the South course. So I guess it will take also longer. It's such an endurance beast, and you need, I know in European racing, you need also luck, but for me, Unbound is a bit like Paris-Roubaix. When you don't have any puncture, any mechanical, it's half of it, you know? But then Unbound is quite, it's a really simple race.
It is, yeah. It's funny.
I mean, you need luck and legs.
Exactly, yeah.
So, and again, with the North course, I don't know how steep the climbs are and the rocks and so on. But yeah, and then the Europeans and the Worlds, or in general, European gravel racing is so much about tactic, race draft. So much more components, you know, like... depends if there are teams working together or not. So, yeah. But I'm actually also really curious how Unbound will be with Mohoric coming in, so the Gravel World Champ with teammates.
He's coming with teammates?
Yeah, that's what I heard. Yeah.
Really?
So I really think that will change the whole dynamic of the race.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to it. Yeah. So that's all. Yeah. American and European Gravel is... It's two different pairs of shoes there.
I'm so curious how teammates could potentially change the race, because I'm still, maybe it's the optimist in me, but I'm kind of skeptical how much even like an 8-guy world tour team could change the race if it's their first Unbound. I just think that there's so many potential mistakes to make, so many mechanicals to have. Sure, they could make the first 6 hours, 7 hours totally different probably, but in a 10 and a half hour race with how much can go wrong, I don't know, maybe, okay, 8 guys would totally change it. But if it's 3 or 4, I don't know. I'll be curious to see.
I mean, I have done Unbound now just twice, but what you always see is like you have like this dip in speed, you know?
Mm.
You make the selection and then you just kind of like rotate all day long until the final.
Yep.
And if you have actually strong teammates, you can change that with attacks early on.
Interesting. Yeah.
And you're right. They have to prepare really well. But I'm pretty sure Mohoric takes it serious, and he will.
That he does, yeah.
And he will prepare with his teammates properly, and also the sponsor behind it will do it. Yeah. So I think it will be, yeah, it will change the dynamic. But then I don't see like big teams coming in, because people always ask me that. Do you think like there will be gravel teams? I mean, to be honest, like just putting us two guys and maybe Vakoc and a team, the budget you need,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I've said that before.
It's not sustainable.
No, it's
not. For one, maybe, I don't know, maybe Canyon does it at one point because they just don't care about money. know? or they have enough marketing budget, I don't know. I don't know, or Specialized or so on. So like the really big brands. But yeah, otherwise I don't think it's sustainable at this point. As long as there's no proper TV coverage where you get like a kind of payback, you can measure it. But now, you know, it's all about like social media and how we as athletes actually communicating. Yeah.
It's so true. It's so true. I'll be really, really curious to see who he convinces to bring over. Because I know some of the other World Tour teams have had a rider that wants to go for it. And there's been conversation about wanting to bring some help. But the team won't sign off on it just because of the liability. I mean, there was the year that Quinn like really beat himself up super bad. In it. It's easy to do. You know, it's such a crazy race. You could put a 5-month hole in your World Tour season.
Yeah. I mean, it's now in his schedule and I think he will come. And but yeah, maybe things change, lead up to the tour when then he has to decide, okay, I have to make a choice here. So
he's such a student of the sport. I can't wait. He's one of probably like the 5 World Tour guys who could roll up to the line and have some good ideas, having like never done Unbound before, like roll up with some sort of bike setup that even those of us who have been doing it for a while would be like, oh, that's actually a really good idea.
I mean, the way he was riding the worlds was crazy. I thought from the beginning, he rides pretty stupid, but he was so motivated. He had his plan and just like stayed with it. And it was crazy to see. And I mean, it paid off in the end.
Describe that, because Keegan didn't tell me about this. Obviously, I was never up there.
Now, he was just always making it hard when it was too easy, riding the front, you know, and taking early on the decision. I mean, at one point, Keegan crashed just before, we were just like 5 guys. So, Verde, me, then Mahoric, and the British guy, and then Vermeersch. And he still kept he could have just stayed in this group, you know, for the next like 100 Ks until the final, but he decided, oh no, I want to make it really hard now. And then like the group split it again. So he just wanted to race really hard all day long. And I can really respect that.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's painful, but I have a lot of respect for that kind of racing.
Yeah. Yeah. Boy, that's interesting. He's got such a massive engine. Obviously, that's the way that some of the guys in the States like to race, but Mohoric's engine. Whew.
Yeah, it's different. I mean, to be honest, like, if you look at Keegan, he's probably one of the best guys in the world on like off-road racing. I'm not so much about like mountain bike, cross-country, but like this whole endurance stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, he showed it at the Worlds. He's able to ride with the best. So, I'm looking forward to that duel and hopefully we are there as well and outplaying them. So.
yeah. Cool. All right, man. I would like to, let's see, what direction should we take this next? Let's talk about your late January ultra distance little side project. I wasn't familiar with this race, but you jumped into the Gran Canaria. What is the name exactly?
Gran Guanche.
Gran Guanche. And basically, so there's these series of islands that people love to go train on in the winter, go on bike vacations. World Tour riders go there to train. How many islands are there, by the way?
I think in total 7.
Okay.
And we crossed 5 of them, yeah.
Yep. So at what point did this... Well, did you ever train on the islands during your World Tour career?
No, not during my World Tour career, but... So my first gravel pro spring, I went there for training camp to Tenerife. but not in altitude, just down on the sea, and did their training camp, and actually did then the Gran Guanche gravel. So there's a gravel mountain bike and a road version, and did it in a team, and we won the team version, the team classification back then. And this year I decided to do it because I know, like, as mentioned, I have like a podcast and we were just talking shit. And then at one point we said, oh, guys, let's do like a holiday or like a cycling vacation. Let's do the trip over the islands and Canarian Islands. And so that's how we came up with it. And so we started there, not as a team, but like with the three of us. And I'd been on a training camp 3 weeks before on Tenerife. So I just went straight from Tenerife training camp to that race and did it just like out of fun. So that it turned into like a race to go for the win wasn't the plan. Mm-hmm. But when there's the possibility, you you take it.
So you were talking earlier about how much you're trusting your own process, training very methodically, and how that's really paid off. Surely this doesn't fit in super well to that.
No, that, I mean, my coach leaves me quite a bit of freedom. Last year, I wanted to do the Atlas Mountain Race.
Did you?
Yeah, I started it, did 500Ks, but I got a saddle sore already prior to the race mm-hmm. in the training camp, and still started, but it got worse. So I decided to stop. And that really took me out for like 2 weeks physically. And yeah, just the same this year. I mean, after the race, he said, we're never going to do that again. That's not smart. It just destroys your physiology, and you're just too tired for too long time. I actually didn't felt that bad afterwards, but then I got sick, and which sidelined me for like 2 weeks. That's why I couldn't do Santa Val. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the smartest decision. I kind of regret it a bit, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah, it cost me too much.
It's physically really or financially?
No, physically.
Yeah.
And financially, that's fun events, you know, like Europe is not as expensive as the States. Yep. So some things are more possible. And no, it just sidelined me for too long. And my heart rate was just like through the roof in training and
really
in resting. So I just felt really bad for like now the last 2 weeks training as well. So I start to feel better now. Yeah, so it just costs too much in the end.
Well, how long was it in total?
Now it's just 700Ks or something. So just 1.5 days. But you have like one night where you're not sleeping. And as a pro athlete, you're not used to that, you know?
Yep.
I mean, Ulrich, which you had on here, it's just used to it. But he's not in high performance endurance athlete, you know, like it's also high performance, but like in a different sense.
Yeah.
And it just destroyed me a bit, even though I didn't went deep in the race, you know, but just this one night of not sleeping and so on. Yeah.
Yeah. So you say you regret it, but how did you find the experience? Did you enjoy riding straight through the night? Did you enjoy the adventure aspect? Or is it not for you?
I mean, I have done Badlands before, so I've done a few.
You have?
Yeah, I've done a few of these things now. Yeah.
Okay.
So I really hate riding in the night alone.
Uh-huh.
With someone, I don't mind, but alone, I don't feel comfortable during the night. And but the whole experience is great. I mean, I love this kind of challenges, you know, I need it as well. So yeah, the experience was great, but yeah, riding through the night on Gran Canaria. So I've been now twice on Gran Canaria. I have crossed it twice, but twice during the night. So I still don't know how it looks.
Classic.
And that's actually really a pity. once on a gravel bike and once on a road bike, and still don't know how it looks like. But it's a great experience. So like for someone who wants to start with like ultra distance racing, I really can recommend it because you have the ferries where you have to stop riding. So it gives you a rest and it's just nice. The weather's good. It's warm, you know, usually. And yeah, it's really cool.
Were you able to nap at all on the ferry rides?
Yeah. And actually, it was so far ahead on Gran Canaria that I could take a hotel for like 2 hours of sleeping there.
Okay,
so nice. That was quite nice. But man, you feel so bad when you just have one set of kit with you.
Yeah.
And you then you have a shower, and then you have to wear again
the same kit.
The jersey is not as bad, but the bib shorts you can literally just like it will stay straight up, you know.
Yeah, just keep its
so
shape.
Just so full of salt and yeah. But no, it's a nice experience.
Yeah. I can't get enough of them, honestly, those sorts of things. Like it calls to me. And I took this past year off because it really does set back your training. Mm-hmm. But there's something about it for me that I just can't turn my back on. But it does take a toll for sure. And I kind of wonder if going that deep can put a bit of a lid on some of your capabilities for the shorter stuff. Like I think sometimes... if you do it, I've had it where you almost get like this crazy super compensation. Like I did during the pandemic, I did an off-road Everesting when everyone was Everesting. I just did a bunch of laps on the single track climb at super high elevation. And at that point it was the biggest ride I'd done. It's like 19 hours, I think. Huge TSS. And I was like, oh man, I'm going to be, I felt so sick afterward, like the worst flu you've ever had type thing. Man, 2 weeks later, I was absolutely ripping. Like I was insane fit. But then there's other times where for whatever reason, maybe because it's bigger, I don't know, it just really sets you back. So you have to be careful for sure.
I mean, guys, like Lachna Mortna.
Dude, what the hell? The more time I spend in the sport, the less what he does makes sense. The less what he can do makes sense.
It makes no sense. And for me, last year at Unbound, he was the strongest rider.
Mm.
And also with the setup he was using, he's just like everything about him makes no sense. And then the performance, you know, and like certain races. It just,
I would be curious to hear whether you ever, since you have your own podcast, whether you say anything that you kind of regret or you get too excited and you exaggerate something.
All the time.
Okay, because I find myself doing it. But with Lachlan, like I run out of words to describe my admiration for who he is as an athlete. Like I don't think people realize, if you spend a lot of time training, if you have a very good idea of what the best cyclist can do for watts per kilo, whatever, if you understand what it takes to do a multi-day effort and you put all that together, it is almost unimaginable how good he is across the board.
Yeah. So that's why, he's a
one
great
of a kind.
Yeah, he's definitely one of a kind for many reasons. I know.
I mean, I've talked to Ulrich about, we didn't really get into it the other day when we were recording, but Ulrich and I had a coffee a couple months ago and he was talking about Lachlan's Tour Divide record. And same thing. He was just like, that was pretty much the most incredible bikepacking performance ever. Like it just absolutely bends your brain.
Yeah.
It's really amazing.
He's crazy. Yeah.
Yep. Anyway, podcasting. I really wish I spoke German because I have a feeling your podcasts are really good.
Yeah. I mean, they're different. So like the Besenwagen, which we started in 2018, I think it's quite big, probably biggest German speaking cycling podcast. There's also like, you know, I think I wouldn't have done that if I still be a professional cyclist. So it was also kind of like good. And yeah, then outside as well, it's just like a gravel podcast turning into like more like a regular podcast, not talking just about gravel with Caroline Schiff.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Just the two of you?
Mm-hmm.
How often do you do that?
So Besenwagen's every week and outside every 2 weeks. And sometimes we do also weekly, depends on the races. If Caro wins Unbound, then we do it weekly. Yeah.
And the first one, what's the premise there? What is that podcast about?
So we started with the slogan, trash talk out of the peloton.
Oh, dang.
So, and that's what it is. It's a lot of like trash talk. sometimes expertise, sometimes kind of journalism, but just a bit. But most of the time, it's just like talking about like cycling stuff, like with the helmets now, you know?
Okay.
And the Alpecin kit, and then about races, giving opinions. So it's just like, yeah, all cycling related. And there's not like we have to make it now a journalistic way or whatever. It's just like, being a bit polemic sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
So like
sort of like Lantern Rouge-ish, but less analysis maybe?
I never watched Lantern Rouge. Would I listen to Lantern Rouge? So I don't know that, but yeah, sometimes I'm just, you know, like saying things to like trigger people.
Really?
Yeah.
How are you making enemies?
No, not enemies, but just speaking my mind, you know?
Okay. No, I know, but do you ever get messages from riders who are like, dude, what the
heck? No, not riders. I think the most, at least German speaking, they know me and they know how I mean it.
Okay.
So it's, you know, it's not like on purpose, but for me, it's important to always like, not always, but speak my mind. You're like, yeah. So if I feel something, then I want to say it. Mm. So if I'm wrong, I'm okay with it, like getting corrected and then saying in the next episode, or maybe that was not correct and so on, but not like, so I'm not going out and say, he did that and that, just to, you know, just to make something up. So it's just, you know, so, but I'm not a journalist and that's how I'm speaking, you know?
Yeah.
If see, I would be a journalist, I will do it differently, but that's not what I am.
Yeah. I'm a little nervous to be super opinionated on here because I don't know. Now that I say that, like, I don't know why I'm nervous to be, but I have so many friends in the sport, you know, I don't want to.
Yeah, me too. But yeah, but you know, I mean, you don't seem like someone who is like that, you know, but I am really, I have an opinion on everything, so which is not good, you know, I'm not someone who just says something to trigger someone, but yeah. Sometimes I want to trigger the public just to make a point, you know?
To have a different perspective.
Yeah, it's like we have in Germany, you know, like this whole thing with like cycling path, like security, people getting more aggressive, you know? And I'm going over the top to make a point. So, but I'm not doing that on like a personal level, yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll start wrapping this up because this has been really nice and long. But I'm curious what it's like for you to balance the podcasting with the training and the racing. Because it's a lot. I mean, I can't imagine having two podcasts. On average, how many shows are you cranking out a year?
So it's 52 with Besenwagen and then around 30 with the other one. Then we're doing live podcasts as well. And Yeah, so around, I don't know, like 92, 100,
Wow. And what have you put in place to be able to maintain that?
I mean, it doesn't take that much time, to be honest. I mean,
I guess you're not curating guests every week.
No, that's someone else. So like we have Besenwagen is a company now. So I'm looking after a certain part of the company. And then we have one guy looking after the guests. So I don't have to do that. And then someone does social media. So, you know, like we're recording every Tuesday. I'm just sitting there without any notes and just...
Really?
Just speaking my mind. So
like shooting from the hip.
It's actually quite easy. But it's how I operate, you know, like with everything I do, like the videos I'm doing, it's always like that. So there's no real script before. I'm lucky enough to have always people around me who understand me and know how I work. And the same with the videographer. He knows how to edit the videos that I like it. And that makes it for me much, much easier. I mean, you're the same. You're doing, some of the fields you do much more than I do, but I think you do more like in a block, huh? like content-wise.
The videos?
Yeah, like in just in general. So it feels you like really prominent, you know, on social media compared to me. But yeah, But last year before Tracker, I was here in Girona, drove down with the car and had like kind of like a meltdown. Hmm. So I was lucky my best friend was with me, but I was sitting in a restaurant. I was like, oh fuck, it's all getting too much, like too much responsibilities with like the partners, podcast, other projects. And that was actually a point where I decided, I want to focus on that, what I truly love, and that's riding my bike and competing. So then when I said, okay, training and competing is first, obviously like my private life is above it, and try to combine it. And, but then the rest is coming. So if I'm not riding fast, my partners won't pay me or won't give me the contracts I have now. So I think, I shouldn't forget that.
Yeah. That's interesting. Are you working with an agent in regards to the business side of things, or doing that all yourself as well?
I did it myself until this year. Now I have an agent just because last year was my first really successful year, you know, and I'm now 37. So I think it's good to give that to someone who has really knowledge how to deal with all these things now. I think so far I was quite good. I had a good hand with like doing the contracts, but now I really want to focus on racing, and I know I have a few more years left. I mean, I keep getting better, but I want to keep focusing on training and doing the stuff I really like, and the rest someone else can do. And then I'm also okay with like giving him a bit of it.
Yeah. I mean, just the invoicing alone eventually can get completely overwhelming without help, I think.
I mean, I read that interview from Pete, who said like more and more agents coming in. I mean, gravel is getting really lucrative for some people now. So I think we will see that even more in the future. And I'm also curious how the sport will evolve from like that early like gold digging phase into now more and more athletes coming in, being more professional, but not having like a real following, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think gravel always will work with like, you need a following plus performance. I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree, because I think there's, to an extent, the people that are passionate about gravel and want to follow it are usually different than the people following the world tour or following like XCO World Cups. And the people that are fans of gravel are also fans of aspects of cycling that are not just performance related. They're interested in the people, they're interested in the aesthetic aspects, the adventures, all that sort of thing. So I think that's a really interesting point, and it will be interesting to see how it develops. I think there will be a couple of races that if you win, you can basically have a good but maybe short career based off that single result, whether it be Unbound or whatever else it ends up being. But to have like a healthy long-term career, I agree that you'll need to be more than a name on a results sheet.
Yeah, and that's complicated to handle.
It is.
It's a lot of organization, and you need, you know, as I said in the off, I don't like to walk around with like doing selfies, you know, or like reels myself, filming myself. And I hope I can avoid it for some time. But I also know that it's important to show your face in the camera and be visible. Yeah.
Yeah. I went through a phase where I did it a lot, and I it's harder now for whatever reason, which is ironic, kind of counterintuitive, but it is awkward. But at the same time, when you do it now, like Lachlan actually does it decently often.
Yeah, but there's also nothing wrong about it. It's just like either you are the person for it or not. It's your personality. Yeah. So.
But I was going to say the engagement, like people just really feel like they know you in that moment. It's like they're FaceTiming with you almost or something.
But then with Lachlan again, it feels so, everything he does feels like he just does it.
Yeah, it's very natural.
So, and then I don't know if there's a bigger plan behind it, but like, you know, like then I wouldn't be surprised if he actually starts training with like two different pairs of socks and two different pairs of shoes, you know, and not realizing it. The other day when he started training without a helmet.
Yeah. How do you do that?
Yeah. I don't know, man.
I think what's going on there is he rides without a helmet to the grocery store or whatever pretty often. Sort of has to be, but.
So like these kind of things, and he just speaks to the camera. But for me, everything has to be perfect all the time. And I try to deliver a really good product. And if you don't care about that, then it's of course much easier. But if you have for yourself a too high standard, then you're limiting yourself. And in that case, I'm limiting myself, but I'm fine with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's your channel and you have to do with it what feels natural.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, we'll wrap this up. What is one bike thing you want to do, whether it's a race that you want to check off the bucket list or some sort of big challenge? Other than what you've already rattled off as goals.
Blah.
It's fine for there not to be anything right now.
Yeah, no, they're actually two things, but they're also goals. You know, I really want to win Unbound, and I really want to go for a medal at the Worlds, and they're two of my goals, and I'm not finished after that, but that's accomplishments I want to get doing my gravel career.
Yeah.
And Unbound earlier than later because I don't have to go back.
Fair enough. Are there any events that you've been watching from afar that you think you'd like to do one day?
No.
Fair enough.
I think I've seen a lot, and I also know that events are most of the time not the perfect circumstance to actually enjoy a place.
So true.
So like going to Colombia, it looks fantastic, but I don't think I want to do it in this stage race format. I would like to do it just on my own, just enjoying it.
Yep.
Yeah. And also something like Badlands, beautiful area, but it's also nice to just like doing 100K every day, taking a hotel and then.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, thanks for doing this. It was really good to get to know you a little bit, and
thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. I look forward to racing with you some this year, and best of luck with the podcast and everything else.
And I really like it that you're coming back for Tracker 200.
Oh, yeah.
And that Pete's coming over for 360. I think he does 360.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's important that the American's coming over more often.
I'm glad you said that, and I agree. It's why I decided to go to Worlds last year, last minute. I think it is important that a good handful of riders participate in the globalization of the sport. Cause, for one, it's humbling. Like it is a different sport. Like I'm very aware that my ability to perform in Europe, has growth. Like I need to get better at it, or I can get better at it, I should say. Like it feels very different, and there's a lot to learn, and it gives you an appreciation for when you guys come over to the States, and that's also a very foreign environment. And you guys are learning a different style of racing, and not to mention all the travel and other challenges that you have to deal with. And then also just being a representative of the sport. You know, I think Pete doing the 360 will be cool, and people will be excited. People who haven't had the opportunity to meet him, there will be people that are excited to meet him. And I agree, it's a global sport, and as much as we can, we should all participate in that.
Exactly.
It's exciting.
It's also a privilege, so.
No kidding.
We should take the opportunities. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm nervous about it. We didn't really talk about it, but you absolutely smashed Traca last year. Like had this crazy mechanical at the end, had to run across the finish line and still won with a huge margin. And after riding some of that course, man, it makes that performance that much more impressive. It is a beast of a race. It's going to be interesting. Americans, come do it.
Yep. Okay.
All right, Paul. Catch you next time.
Thank you.
Hello again, everyone. Thank you so much for listening today. Once again, I want to say a big thank you to Athletic Affair for supporting our podcast this entire 3 months we've been in Girona, letting us use their studio. They really, really hooked it up. Bent over backwards more than a couple of times to accommodate our nutty schedule. And I feel very grateful to count them as friends at this point. I also want to say a big thank you to Lily McKelvin for editing and producing each and every one of these shows, and a big thank you to Nicole Baker for producing this show. If you'd like to see the video aspect, video version of today's interview with Paul Voss, you can go to my YouTube, which is just my name, watch the full interview, or stay tuned to the social channels. It's just The Adventure Stash on Instagram for little clips, our Friday quizzes, and just staying more up to date day to day. Thank you all so much for listening today, and we will catch you next week.